This CD is a production of All Roads Ministry, or ARM. It is a recording of a discussion that took place in the spring of 2005 in Louisville, Kentucky. The primary participants in this discussion are Vin Lewis, founder and president of ARM, and Bill Walsh, a well-known Catholic and social activist in the Louisville community. We hope that you enjoy the CD and benefit from it. The recording will now pick up in the middle of Mr. Walsh's introduction. Thank you for listening.
A few other things as the years went on. I be 66 years old this summer, baptized at St. Elizabeth. Went to St. Elizabeth and St. Stephen's and St. X and St. Joseph's College, where I got a degree in my grandchildren. I've been trying to keep the lights on and the heat on and, floor swept in here for the last 7 or 8 years. That's part of the Mount of Retirement Project. That's who I am.
Excellent. And we have Vin Lewis. Vin, would you say a few words about yourself?
Hi, Mom. Go Cardinals.
Yes.
Both University of Louisville and College of. College of Cardinals, get it? Okay.
Thank you.
They'll be needed soon.
Yeah.
Well, anyway, that isn't enough.
Okay.
I would simply like to say thank you for inviting me here. I'm a big Mount New Yorker who's also known as a social parasite, trying but so far unsuccessfully to live off of welfare and food pantries in New York State. And I would like to say if your job is keeping the heat on, you're doing a rotten job because it's cold in here.
You're invited. And
thank you.
There's plenty of room in there for this group.
Yes, there is. Why don't you people go in there and we'll keep talking. Anyway, that's enough for me.
Okay, we're looking forward to an exciting conversation. And I think some of the topics that we were going to be discussing were evangelization methods, the size of the church. Is the size of the Catholic Church necessary? Is it something that is functional in today's world?
What about this trend toward megachurches?
The trend towards megachurches?
What's that teach us, if anything?
That's another question. So really, and you know, those things, and really anything else that we care to discuss today. So, Bill, would you like to begin with that question?
With a question?
Sure. And if it's okay, can we just sort of let you guys just have
a conversation? How about a definition of evangelization?
Evangelization, you want one? Are you asking me? Okay, evangelization is the presentation. The last bit of advice I got from a friend who drove me to the airport was don't speak too quickly. But unfortunately, I think that's genetic in me. So if I go too quickly, I apologize. You can ask me later to slow down or obtain a tape of this if it's ever available. Evangelization is the presentation of the faith to a non-believer with the goal of him accepting it as true. Now, you could also say it is the presentation of an element of the faith to a non-believer to the goal of expecting it as true. So in other words, you could say evangelism is both this is why Catholicism is true or this is why purgatory actually exists. Both of those would be evangelism, that act. Your turn.
I need clarification, because you did talk too fast for me.
Okay.
Evangelization is to defend a particular teaching of the church?
No, that's apologetics.
Okay, what's evangelization vis-a-vis purgatory?
Well, it would be the presentation of the proofs to a person. The way I usually put it, now this is my own personal technique, so therefore vastly superior to anybody else's, and it is to prove that everybody already believes in purgatory. All people who believe in the existence of God already accept purgatory. Therefore, then I would, once I establish that as a fact, I would then say, now, does not your outward witness, that is what you say you believe, should it not be in accord with what you believe in your heart, or are you a man divided against yourself and then cannot stand? In that case, then I would say, then, therefore, make this next step, come into the church which proves, which validates purgatory, which you already believe, and therefore become a Catholic.
Okay, the come into the church, that phrase, jumped out at me. In the press, in the secular press, frequently evangelization and proselytizing are used interchangeably. What's the difference?
In my opinion, there is no difference, but I may be wrong. My understanding of the word proselytizing is to get someone to accept whatever your belief system is. So I believe they're the same. I think one's a Latin root and one's a Greek root. That's all.
Grunting over here, and why?
I understood.
It's okay if other people.
What do you
respond?
Think? Is that okay?
Oh, I have no objection. Oh, I'm sorry. I have no objection as long as I'm the other people.
Okay, go ahead. We need a moderator, and
I'm it.
I can't be a moderator and participant.
I can do that.
You can do that.
I'm the moderator. So can we sort of stay informal, but at the same time...
As a moderator, that's your choice.
Okay. What we're going to do is allow questions. I'm just going to go ahead and choose based on the content and sort of what I'm hearing. And, we'll, you know, and that's fine. So please feel free to participate as you will. I missed that last section. Does anyone have anything to...
Sounds
great. Yes, please.
Difference between proselytizing and
evangelizing.
And what's your name? Because I love to know people's names.
Marianne.
Speak loudly because it is being recorded.
Okay. I understood proselytizing was personal witness, or evangelization was presenting facts from of our Lord.
You may be right. It was. I only gave you my impression. I never sort of looked it up in a dictionary or came to my own conclusion about what proselytizing means. Okay. I'm under the impression. And I don't use the word. I try to be careful and not use words that I'm not sure of the exact meaning of. And so therefore I don't use the word. That's why I use evangelism.
Well, I guess I should give you my distinction of the two words. Although, since I brought up, it seemed unfair or something like it's rhetorical. Proselytizing is trying to convince and even enlist, recruit into your organization, be it a church or whatever, the Elks Club. Members, and evangelization is to share your faith, to tell people what you believe. And it's that simple. To tell the story, even. The first evangelists were at least the term was used for Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, who told the story that they had witnessed or had contact with witnesses of.
Would there be any difference between evangelism and instruction, then?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Instruction comes later. To some extent, this is not just me talking. This is what I've been picking up from talking to other people. Evangelization is really the first stage. It's to witness the faith. It's to say, I'm a Christian. This is who I am. This is what I believe. This Christ story is the center of my life. And then if somebody wants more explanation, they want to make some sense out of that, and then move to the next phase, which would be instruction. That's the way I understand it.
I don't understand the word witness as a verb. I never did. What does to witness the faith mean?
I agree. By the way, I don't particularly approve of it either. I'm using somebody else's language. It means to speak on behalf of not only pretty much your own experience, too. You know, the way to present a faith, certainly there's value in doing it with a kind of deductive process. You believe this, don't you? Therefore, this is going to follow. But for a lot of people, evangelicals, with the big E, you know, this is my witness. This is what happened to me. This is how I feel. This is my life. Take it or leave it. It's sort of a piece of evidence. It's just like the original witness to the resurrection. I saw him. I talked to him. I ate with him. Oh, darn. And they went from there. And so people today, there are people today who say, you know, I know him. It's part of, it's my life. It's who I am. It governs everything I do. And then people can respond to that if they want to go to the next step. They can even join up if they want to.
It appears to me that the original witnesses of the resurrection, or the evidence of the resurrection, since apparently the only witnesses were Romans, presented it with the purpose of what I call evangelization.
Yes.
They didn't simply say, he's risen. They said, he's risen, so therefore, do something.
Yes.
And as a matter of fact, our Lord chided them for not believing. It appears to me that, therefore... That, now, I'm not saying this is all form of witnessing, but you're using that as a specific example. That would be what I call evangelization. In other words, in the true sense of the word, a conversion attempt, as opposed to simply, I'm here.
Well,
let me draw a distinction, if I may, and why I object to the concept of witnessing. I have often told Catholics that one of the absolute horrors of purgatory is listening to a whole bunch of conversion stories by Protestants. I've listened to a bunch, and I'm telling you, it is a terror, it is a horror, it is unbelievable. And what it does is it focuses on the individual and leaves God out almost completely, except for one mention usually in the beginning. And as I also wondered, was there ever a Protestant who wasn't a drug-dealing wife-beater? Apparently every single one who ever became born again was first a drug-dealing wife beater. And I find this, okay, I'm asking you what you think you must do to be saved. I'm asking you what the role of works and faith are. I'm asking this, and you're telling me how terrible you were and how happy you are now. It seems to me that you're trying sort of to sell me how wonderful you are and focus on the individual. And there's an awful lot of eyes in there. Mm-hmm. And there's not a lot of God in me. And I think that that's the danger. And again, if you remember, St. Peter Pentecost gets up and gives a speech and tells these people, the Jews who were visiting from different places, and they said, what have we got to do? And he said, repent and be baptized. He didn't say, listen more, share more, and I'll be back for session two later. He followed it up with essentially a command. And what I'm saying is that's why I worry. I've often heard people say, that mostly Catholics, by the way, especially that I knew, and I don't like the word pro-life, but in the pro-life movement, that they felt that the fact that they were acting against abortion in an open way would give witness, quote-unquote, to their Protestant colleagues and help bring them into the church. But they didn't have to then invite them or prove anything. And I always said, you see them do the same thing you do. Are you now tempted to become a Lutheran or an Episcopalian? And they would say, no. And I'd say, why? And they said, well, I don't see any reason to. And I said, exactly the point. You're not presenting a reason. You're only presenting happiness. And if I could use sort of maybe a bad analogy, the University of Louisville's basketball team is in the Final Four. And obviously a great many fans will be rooting for the Cardinals in the next game. Now, they will look across the stadium and see a whole bunch of people rooting for somebody else. Under no circumstances will that induce them to change sides and say, well, you know, those people are rooting for the University of Michigan. I think I should join them. Look how happy they are. Look, they're wearing green. I like green rather than red. I think that's a good reason for me to change my team loyalty. No. There may be a way to talk fans out of their loyalty. And there's reasons why people change teams. But I don't think it's ever because they look at someone else and say, I admire them. A Red Sox fan doesn't become a Yankee fan because he wants to win World War Series. Or win more World Series. And what I'm saying is, I think this witnessing is a, what we call witnessing, this outward sharing, this talking, or this testimony, is very frequently a substitute for actual action that leads to concern for somebody. And I'm not against symbolism. At times, you can only do symbolic actions. But what I'm saying is, it appears to me that that's a perhaps false symbol that separates a person from actually taking direct action and invitation. And I've spoken enough.
Yeah.
Yes, you agree I've spoken enough.
Good. No, I just...
All right.
I was going to respond here. And
oh, I'm sorry. But jump in next time.
Each one...
jump in next time.
Let me pick it up somewhere. First of all, mostly I agree with you. Maybe I should speak, you know, cut to the chase and speak to the whole notion of witnessing, protesting, telling your story, your conversion story, your born-again story. So, I don't have one, but I don't apologize for that. But I have know plenty of people who do, and I don't criticize them or judge them or condemn them for that. I think that there are a lot of different ways in which we come to God, we experience faith, so forth and so on. And I'm not a very Buddhist term about the small raft? It's a Sanskrit word, whatever it is. You know, this way.
Vinyata and Vinyata?
Yeah, one of those.
Okay, right.
One
the larger vessel, the smaller
right,
vessel.
Right. You know, this way or no way. I'm not. But here's my question. Started. You say you aren't going to look over there and see people rooting for the other team and say they look so happy. Or don't. Do you really think that you can persuade people with a coherent argument to the faith?
Yes. But that does not mean to say that they'll accept it. I'll try to draw a distinction. I am convinced that the O.J. Simpson jury absolutely positively knew that O.J. Simpson was guilty. Of course, they voted him innocent for various different reasons. But the point is, they knew he was guilty. It didn't affect their behavior. Because what it did was appeal to their intellect, but it didn't affect their human will. In the same sense that very frequently wives and mothers who are married to adultering husbands or having juvenile delinquent sons will know that the 15th time the policeman comes to the house and says your son was involved in something, they know the 15th time the guy comes home late with lipstick on his collar, that he's cheating or the guy or the kid is turning out bad. But their will prevents them from accepting it in terms of actually acting upon it. So the point I'm making is yes, you can convince someone intellectually of the faith. It's easy to do. Mm-hmm. But that doesn't mean to say that they will then use the will to make themselves in conformity. The simplest example I can use is pretty much every time I get finished with confession, I really, really will not to sin again. And there I am back, say, 2 or 3 weeks later, confessing the same things again. My intellect really said, listen, Vin, avoid sin, do virtue, gain indulgences, avoid time in purgatory, avoid hell. Here you know the right path to stay on, but you know, I don't always do it. And sometimes when I drive, I say, that guy cut me off, I'm going to forgive him. And sometimes I say, no, I'm not going to forgive him, I'm going to get him back. I keep making mistakes. Every student who seriously takes a test really tries to get every answer correct. Sometimes they make mistakes. Sometimes they willingly, because of a certain reason, screw up. And this is the point I'm making is they may have the knowledge, they may actually be convinced the knowledge is right, but they still do the wrong thing because each man is still supreme in his own will, always.
Let me tell you what I think and then about my question, and you respond to it again. Maybe we'll be more focused. I don't think anybody ever listens to any argument, political, religious, or any other, and say, by golly, you're right. Henceforth, I'm going to do it your way. Because of all the things you say. You call it will, you can also call it just ego, determination to, you know, to be myself and not to conform to you, whatever. At the same time, I don't think anybody can be talked out of faith either. I don't think you can come along and argue that you believe that Jesus rose from the dead, but I can make a coherent argument that resurrection is a natural impossibility and blah, blah, blah. That's not the effect of anybody either. I don't think this notion of creationism or Darwinianism is a big deal. I don't think it has much to do with it. For example, I don't think that science and logic, maybe what I think is that they come later. They can reassure you if you've got faith. But I don't think they're going to lead you to faith. What do you think?
Faith is a gift from God.
Yes.
And without the virtue of faith, given infused at baptism, you cannot properly believe what you are supposed to believe and properly reject what you are supposed to reject. However, I disagree on your statement. Unless we are to deny convert stories into Catholicism, who argue that when they do tell their conversion stories, that they noticed this, they noticed this, they concluded this, they concluded that, and came to the point that God would bridge the last gap by the gift of faith. So they use their own goodwill to get to the point of willingness to accept the faith.
Generally speaking, because I'm sure you're much more familiar with these stories than I am, where are these people coming from? Are they coming from other Christian denominations, or they come from atheism? Or
the ones I'm familiar with have definitely come from other Christian denominations. And the point I use is, because again, we were outside an abortion clinic, it takes a person of even sub-average intelligence about 40 seconds to figure out abortion is wrong. If he then figures out that he has to be in accord with God's plan that holds that abortion is wrong, that means a particular religion or denomination, he then must become a Catholic because we're the only ones who oppose abortion.
We're the only ones who probably have a position on it, right?
No, we're the only ones who oppose it. In the sense of, when you oppose something, you actually inflict the penalty for it. In other words, if I'm against burglary and you try to burgle my house, I will call the police and try to have a penalty inflicted upon you. If I'm physically able, I'll restrain you. I'll prevent you. If I have a child and my child misbehaves and I'm against that, I will inflict a penalty.
I see. In other words, only if you're excommunicated do you oppose. Only if you use excommunication.
Not only. That wouldn't be the only thing. But the point I'm trying to make is there are no other penalties in other systems. Mm-hmm. And as the analogy I've used, which I think is a good one, is if there were a sign upon entering a political jurisdiction that said speed limit 30 miles an hour, never enforced, you would be literally giving permission to speed and say, we're not against speeding. Now, put a sign up, say, strictly enforced. Or put a sign up, fines for speeding doubled in one year. You're now saying, hey, listen, we don't want you to do this. And we're going to get, if we're not going to catch you all the time, but if we do catch you, we're going to penalize you. All other systems say, a lot of them do formally oppose abortion, but then they impose no penalties whatsoever, which is the same as saying it's perfectly allowed.
Would you say, wait a minute now, does the Catholic Church impose penalties for every sin?
No, the Catholic Church doesn't impose administrative penalties. God imposes penalties for every sin, but this particular one is a formalized institutional statement involving a specific formalized penalty.
Does that mean that they don't really oppose the other sins, that they don't have an institutional penalty for?
No, it's simply a matter of, it's simply a personal opinion, that one reason it was done, although maybe they didn't intend to at the time, was to allow evangelists like me to make the point. It allows us a very useful tool.
Yeah, but it's not consistent.
No, that's not true at all.
You say that, well, excuse me, just a second, maybe I'm not clear. If the Catholic Church does not impose a penalty for spouse abuse, then they don't oppose it.
No, there's a penalty already imposed from God.
Well,
on
there
spouse
is
abuse.
The same thing's true of abortion.
That's right.
So if the Presbyterian Church does not oppose an institutional penalty for abortion, but it's already imposed by God, then they don't need to. What's the consistency?
Their view is that the opposition of God is literally impotent and means absolutely nothing.
They are whom?
The Presbyterians are all Protestants believe that God, in essence, all Protestants are in essence functional atheists because, as far as they're concerned, the functionality of God doesn't exist.
Good Lord.
God is a rubber stamp God is the ticket taker at the theater who has to let you in if you have the ticket. There's no judgment
involved.
Wait a
minute. I certainly don't want to be put in a position to defend the Protestants. I'm not a Protestant.
Mm-hmm.
But you're saying that Protestants are effectively atheists.
Yes. By the way, most Catholics are, too, just so we'll be sort of ecumenical about it. As I say, there's about 9 of us in this country who believe in God, and I know them all by first name.
Okay.
I'm one.
I'm not going to oppose that.
Okay.
May I ask?
Sure.
If there's moral sin involved, then the Catholic Church imposes a penalty on moral sin, period.
No, the Church doesn't impose a penalty on it. God imposes a penalty on it. The Church imposes other penalties for administrative actions to overemphasize opposition.
Okay.
Let me. I think I can clear it up.
Murder and refuses to confess that.
Yeah.
Is excommunicated by the Church, but that's not.
No, he's not excommunicated. Murder is not an excommunication offense. It's a normal offense.
It takes you out of communion with the Church.
Wait a minute. Mortal sin, for those who are not aware, mortal sin is a serious offense committed knowingly and willingly by a person. At that point, the soul, we use this word dead. At that soul, the point, the soul becomes dead. If a person dies in that state, he will be damned to hell. So what he needs to do is to get the sin removed and get himself restored into what we call a state of grace. Now, what I'm saying is the following. A mortal sin certainly would be murder, and abortion is murder. But the specific act of abortion carries with it an administrative penalty of excommunication. This means you are cut off from the Church the same as if you were a non-Catholic. You're not allowed to attempt to receive Holy Communion. You're not allowed to receive other sacraments until the excommunication is removed. I think an analogy will make it clear. O.J. Simpson was criminally prosecuted for murder and acquitted. But then he was civilly prosecuted for murder and found guilty.
Not for murder.
Wrongful death, if I remember correctly.
Yeah.
Okay, sorry.
Somehow interfering with her civil right to get up the next morning.
You are correct. I was incorrect in using the word murder. But the point was that this is an extra penalty which can be thrown on by an additional part of the court system. Sometimes only civil penalties are imposed, sometimes only criminal penalties, sometimes neither, sometimes both, even though it's the same action. So the excommunication by the Church might be considered a civil action. The penalty imposed by God is a criminal action. Right? So I think that would be a way to understand it. And the fact that the Church does not impose civil penalties on everything does not mean that they don't oppose everything. It means that they simply make a prudential decision on when to impose civil penalties and when not to.
Yeah, because it does.
Go ahead.
It does become symbolic. I'm sure you agree. I mean, you can, in a sense, you go to communion with mortal sin on your soul, and it's sacrilegious.
Yes.
And you go to communion, or you attempt to receive communion after you've been excommunicated, and the priest can say no.
Right.
Because that's probably the only difference. If he knows. I mean, if the priest happens to realize that you've been excommunicated.
Well, when you're excommunicated, you don't get the benefit of the activity of the church, in essence. You're cut off from it.
Right, and yeah. Same is true if you're not in state of grace.
Yes, but one,
but one of them one, is yeah. public and symbolic.
Symbolic,
and the other is
you're
private.
Right. You're right, you're right.
No, I'm going to say, do we want to stay on this topic?
No.
Go ahead, jump.
Okay,
whatever.
Can we shift to something else?
Sure.
No. Yes.
Might I ask a question?
Sure.
Okay.
You did. That's it. Any other questions?
Next question.
No, that's quick.
Thank you.
I want to get back to this term witness, which I don't care for either, but clearly, let me play the Protestant here and use a scriptural example. We know that in the Acts of the Apostles, in the New Testament, there are clearly false witnesses, in addition to true witnesses, obviously. The perfect example, I guess, is Simon Magus, right? Because we know that at one time he followed St. Peter. Now, what were his motives, right? It might just be that Simon Magus might have converted someone in that he said, you know, yes, I'm following this God-man, Jesus Christ. And he very well could have been in the state of mortal sin, and probably was in the state of mortal sin, because we're then told in Acts about his malicious character.
Is there a question?
Yes, I'm getting to that. The question is, there must be a medium whereby we distinguish what is a true Christian witness from a false Christian witness, right? And I guess I just wanted to throw that out.
Well, it still wasn't a question.
Try it again. You want to reframe it?
Okay. You're correct. It wasn't a question. Let me give this additional point and then see if you might form your own question, if you don't see a question in my question. Witness to me seems to give a secondary connotation in that a person's in the state of sanctifying grace.
Why do you say that?
Here's the question.
That's a false one.
Well, let us, for the sake of the argument, say that the Antichrist comes up to me and says, you know, I heard about this guy, Ben Lewis, and he thinks there's no salvation outside the church. And let us say that I'm just a pagan. I know nothing about the church. But I go investigate the Catholic Church. And maybe the Antichrist is not such a good example, but I'm using it anyway. I go investigate the church. The Antichrist was the instrumental means whereby I investigated the church. Because the Antichrist told me about this man, Ben Lewis, who says there's no salvation outside the church. But is the Antichrist truly a witness in the sense that we understand the term witness? Is that a question?
Yeah, my answer is I don't know.
Yeah, it's a question, but I still have a problem with the word witness as a noun. I would summarize
as a
my
verb.
No, in this case, as a noun.
Where do you like it?
I don't like it at all. That's why I don't use it except in court. See, I try to be very precise in my language, and what I find is that when we use these amorphous terms, okay, that we therefore can avoid actually coming down to what we have to say and have to mean. I would say this. There are people who tell the truth about what Christ taught. There are people who don't tell the truth about what Christ taught. Even if he's otherwise evil, if a person tells you the truth and therefore gives you truth and that helps you because you're digestive, he's done you a favor. And does that mean can evil people bring about good results? Of course, absolutely, do all the time. Okay? And so therefore, even if the Antichrist gave you a truth with the hope of misleading you, if it turned out to be correct, then he had achieved a good result, even though his intention was otherwise. I use it all the time, the analogy. Two bank robbers hold up a bank, come out and have a shootout with the police. One bank robber mistakes and shoots the other bank robber. He didn't mean to do it, but he did a good act because he killed someone who was going to kill the police. So we don't give him a medal because his intention wasn't good and his aim was bad, but we rejoice in the fact that there's one less criminal there endangering the public welfare. And so that's why, see, I understand the word bear witness. Bear witness literally means to be in a situation where you say, this is true, I'm standing up for it, I'm taking an oath, I'm affirming it, as you would do in court. I understand bearing witness. And I understand a witness says he will now come forth and be tested, you know, be sworn in. I understand that too. But two witnesses is a little sloppy to me, and witness as you were doing it. See, is Simon Magus a witness? I thought he was a magician who thought that the apostles had some magic powers which he could buy. Now, that's, I think, the legend and the few comments in the Acts of the Apostles. That wouldn't make him a witness. That would make him a businessman who thought he could improve his act. And that the fact that he went the wrong way makes him evil, but not anything more than that. I'm sorry.
That's okay. I want to just interrupt for a second. Are we going to go to Mass at 12 o'clock?
I already went to church.
Oh, you did?
Yes, I went to this guy's church, though.
Okay, I just
jumped up and down and shouted and
left. Are you ever going to Mass again? Okay. Anyone else?
No, I'm not going again, for God's sake. Not that much of a Catholic.
All right, then I guess we continue. Can we start at 11:30? What time would you like to end? Let's go ahead and just decide that. I've got one other idea for a good segue into kind of what we've been talking about, but let's come up with a time. I know you've got...
And I haven't been to Mass, but I was going to forego it today.
12 o'clock, St. Louis, Mass?
I know, I can still do that if we want to cut it off short, but I'm willing to stay until 12 or after.
Right.
Stay 12, 10 or something.
I like that idea.
Okay, very good. Okay, then I was thinking about authority in the church. Now, this is something we've kind of been hinting around, and it's something that's kind of a prelude to what I'm sure we're going to be discussing tonight. Can we kind of throw that out a little bit? Let me go ahead and pose a question then. Why or how is a Catholic bound by authority? What does that actually mean for a Catholic? And then also perhaps for a Christian, say our Protestant brethren, what implications would authority have for a Protestant as well, or any Christian, let's say?
Well, first you ask, can we throw out authority? No, we can't, otherwise we become Protestants. Joke. All right. I guess
true
I'm
too.
Speaking way too quick for you Kentucky people. way too quickly. Authority is a status given to a person or an institution which allows them to make binding decisions in certain jurisdictions. And therefore, it can never be forced. It's interesting that for a judge that got shot down in Atlanta, used to be that in most courts, they didn't have any guards at all. Because it was always assumed that people accepted the authority of the court.
Mm.
That guy didn't accept the authority of the court, obviously. So therefore, he shot the judge, a few other people, got out, because he used power. The point they're trying to make is, and I'm not original with me, people who use power don't have authority, people who use authority don't have power. The two are completely different. Because authority can only be given by the people subject to it. The myth of America is that we are governed by a government to whom we have given our consent.
Well, wait a second. The Catholic Church does have authority and it does have power.
What power?
How many legions does the Pope
have? Right. What power?
Divine
power. No, okay. That's a very good point. That's a spiritual power, and I will now draw a distinction. What I meant by that is a physical power on earth, okay? If the Pope were to say something like, certain person is a saint and you didn't agree, he can't throw you in jail on account of that. He has no one to come to drag you off. Even when papal states existed and popes had temporal power, it was really quite different from the regular office. It was they as a ruler of the land. Okay.
Which they still had power to enforce at that time. I mean,
yes,
at that
but the
time,
point was it wasn't spiritual.
Even when they had temporal power?
Yeah, that's exactly the point. Temporal power is not spiritual authority.
Okay.
And it would depend on the deference of the subject.
No, that's exactly my point. You must give consent to authority.
Yep.
If you think about a normal husband and wife situation, the husband has this spiritual authority over the wife. Now, in the real sense of the word, the wife has to give it, because the only way the husband can enforce it is become a brute and beat her up, and then all of us look down on him. So what it is really the marriage, one of the aspects of the marriage ceremony, is the wife accepting the authority of the husband as now being head of the family. And if she doesn't, it's really not a marriage. It's sort of a civil union. And that's the whole point about authority. So the point I'm trying to make is, In Catholicism, the authority of the church has to be accepted by the members of the church. And what they're saying is, and authority is a concept in advance, I accept in advance your ability to tell me what is right, what is wrong, and I accept it in advance. I don't hold a reserve.
From that flows power.
No. From that, no power flows at all, because there is no power from authority. Again,
he's using power a special way, and I agree with what
yes.
you're saying.
Power is the ability to cause or prevent something from happening. Authority is the status of making decisions. And again, if the authority is accepted, there's no power necessary. If a man sues his tenant and says, the guy hasn't paid me rent, and he goes to court to have him evicted, judge gives him an eviction notice, and he serves it on the tenant. If the tenant accepts the authority of the judge, he now moves his stuff out. If he doesn't accept the authority, then the police got to come in and kick in the door and use physical force and power. That's why power and authority are exclusive. One is a substitute for another, never at the same time.
I would also like to say that authority is the flip side of responsibility. If I give you authority over me, I accept out, at the same time giving you responsibility for me. Insofar as you have authority over me, or I have authority over anybody, I have responsibility for those people.
I'm sorry.
Authority is the right to do something, isn't it? Power would be the ability to do it.
Authority is separate from rights. Okay, it can be a rightful authority. It can be a wrong authority. Okay, as an example, again, the myth of America is the consent of the governed. But those Indian tribes didn't agree with that. Were put on reservations and then told, if you don't behave in a certain way, we're going to throw you in prison. As a matter of fact, that's rough for all of us. I don't remember anybody ever asking me if I accepted the Constitution. So this government is like all the governments, automatically oppressive. Doesn't mean it's worse than others, but all governments are oppressive. They have to be by nature. What I'm saying is that the right authority, which the church has, the Catholic Church has, is one thing. These gentlemen belong to a Baptist church. I'm sure their pastors have a certain authority over that congregation, even to determine when the services are. They're not right because they're not in the true church, and therefore they're not running a religion correctly, but the man still has that authority. And if there were a problem that came, it could be settled by a court. And the thing about the authority, again, is when you go to a court, you're accepting in advance what the decision is going to be, even if you appeal it later. You don't walk out of a court saying, well, they decided guilty when they really decided innocent. You may say, we're going to appeal it, but you actually have accepted the verdict as being what it is. You don't say it means nothing. See, these gentlemen, their pastor has no authority over me. I don't care what he says, and they don't care, I would think, well, what a Catholic official says, you know, as far as authority goes. The authority, again, has to be a matter of the willingness of the subordinate to accept the position, the status of the superior. And in Catholic practice, what this means is that our free will has really one purpose, and that is to destroy itself. You submit yourself to God through the church, and at that point you say, I am a slave, I no longer have a free will in matters religious, in matters moral, in matters ritual. What I now have a free will in is whether I can root for the Cardinals or for Michigan State. But those are allowed. But as I said yesterday in a talk I tried to give, the role of religion is to permeate every aspect of life in which it can possibly have any influence whatsoever. And therefore, at that point, you make judgments, but you make no decisions in the way of free choice.
Okay, so, getting back to authority again, what are Catholics bound to accept by virtue of authority?
The teachings of the Church on what is right, as regard to faith and morals, what one must believe, one must reject as true, and what one must advocate as proper to do, and one must reject as improper.
But now we're talking about, and you follow what I'm saying, all the different types of teachings from the United States or the American Council of Bishops to what's actually spoken in Rome, to doctrine, to dogma. Maybe I know it's a generic question, but there's a lot of teaching that permeates the Church. Universal.
Yeah, but
also local.
But you see, again, the American Council of Catholic Bishops is not an official Catholic organization. It's a essentially political action committee. For something to be authorized official Catholic, it has to go back to the time of the apostles. And this is the point that people don't seem to understand.
So would you say we're not bound to accept anything that the American Council of Bishops? I'm sorry, the National... What is it?
National Council of Catholic Bishops.
National Council of Catholic Bishops.
You're not bound to accept anything that they say because they say it. So even if they came out tomorrow and said abortion is a horrible sin, you're not bound to say accept it because they say it. You're bound to accept it because it's the will of God and has already been revealed through the by God through the Church. So the point is, you know, except for things like devotions, as the rule for a Catholic is, once in, always in, and always in from the beginning. And the beginning is the death of the last apostle, St. John. That's when what Catholics call the positive faith was closed. That means that the revelation given by God to the apostles ended with the death of the last apostles. At that point, Catholicism was closed, except for things like devotions and additional saints,
okay.
That type of stuff.
Bill, can I ask you
but faith and morals were fixed.
In terms of authority in the church.
Okay. I don't know. Authority in the church. First of all, I do like my idea that authority is the flip side of responsibility. He who has authority has responsibility, and the two are twin. Don't give me responsibility for this place unless I have authority. And if I accept no responsibility for what goes on here, then I don't have any right to authority. So I think that's an important point. And I was a classroom teacher. My authority was not because I could whoop the whole class or because I had a gun at my door, but because I was responsible for their well-being, their safety, and also their academic progress and well-being. And I can't accept that responsibility if they don't grant me the authority in that classroom. That's where my authority comes from, because I accept responsibility for my kids, for anywhere. The coach is responsible for the team. That's why he's got authority over the team. Now, authority in the church. I believe that the church has authority, and it's a responsible authority. It's authority with the consent of the church. But I think that there are people for whom the authority of the church, whether they admit it or not, becomes almost its principal component. That somehow holding up the authority of the church, trying to find out what the church teaches, trying to conform to it, but becomes their faith. And I'm a little uneasy about that.
Well, that's because it has been attacked. Because the authority of the church has been attacked, so we have responded in kind. Otherwise, we wouldn't have had to. And it wouldn't have become such a big deal. So I'm just justifying the positions of those that feel like the issue of authority is important.
You know, and I just wonder, Bill...
I would almost go so far as to say it's almost a, pardon my phrase, necessary evil. The church has to have authority. Those of us who belong to the church have to acknowledge that authority and have to abide by it. But that's not what the faith is all about. That's not my position.
The church receives its authority from Jesus Christ. He receives his authority from the Father, states in Scripture. If we teach through the authority of the church, receiving that authority from the church and giving it to others. The authority, I think, I agree with him, authority doesn't change. Responsibility is not the flip side of authority. The flip side of authority is nil.
Well, I don't mean the opposite of. I mean the two of them are, maybe I didn't mean that at all. No. You can't have one without the other. They're twins. There is no authority without responsibility, not true authority without responsibility.
If you said, like, they would give a Baptist pastor the authority to set the times of service, but there is nothing in giving him that authority that says he has to be accountable. He can set the time of service at a time that imposes an extreme hardship on the congregation. So it's...
Well, you can misuse it, but it is his responsibility to set the time of service. If I have the authority to do it, I have the responsibility to do it.
Right, but he doesn't have the responsibility to do it directly. He just has to...
Oh, well, that's a judgment call. I don't get into that. Sure, you can always abuse anything. That's right. There's nothing that can't be abused.
But Jesus has authority over us. We can't say that he has responsibility over us. His responsibility and accountability comes from his love for us.
Well,
not from his authority.
Yeah, that's the same true of a lot of people.
Uh-huh.
A lot of people are like that. You know, my love for a child, for my child, or a child that I'm taking care of. Ideally, my responsibility is a manifestation of my love. And my authority is an act of love. Ideally, I know everything's not ideal.
Bill, can I ask you this? Because kind of what I hear you saying, have you ever read C.S. Lewis, The Abolition of Man?
No.
Okay.
Not that I know of.
Well, I know that he talks a lot about sort of core concepts, the objective reality of things like authority, trust, honor, respect, that these are sort of static, that they're not subject to change. So I guess what I'm wondering is when you say that that's not what the church is all about, in lieu of authority, I hear a diminishment of authority, that authority can be less than that what it actually is. And I'm kind of wrestling with that. And maybe that's just an interpretation of what, but that's what I heard.
Mm.
And would you say that might be accurate?
In most cases, I believe church authority comes after fact. The church doesn't arbitrarily proclaim that this is what you must believe, this is what you must do. Rather, there's an organic reality there, and a controversy comes up, and people don't know what's right. They don't know what to believe, they don't know what to do. They turn to the church. The church has a responsibility to the people. They help the people understand what's right, what they must do, and the church then makes a decision.
So in
and
essence,
that decision should be held as an authoritative decision.
So in essence, what you're
saying... But it comes after the fact in most cases, at least ideally. I think I don't think we begin with that. I think we end with that, or not end, but we get to a point where we need authority. We need to go ask Dad, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Your kids are squabbling, go ask Dad, go ask the teacher,
right.
Go ask Father, go ask the coach, go ask the boss.
But
he steps in because he has the responsibility to do that, and he has the authority to settle the dispute.
So in essence, what you're saying is the responsibility is not there, or it's not level to where it needs to be in order to justify the authority. Then the authority is diminished. That would be your stance, which is in the case of what the church, and maybe we're talking about contraception, perhaps, or divorce, and some of the rules of the church, and which are not, doesn't seem...
Well, those are good examples.
Okay.
Let me make sure I'm being clear. The church never pronounced on contraception before there was contraception. Contraception exists. People are choosing contraception. Some people feel it's right, some people feel it's wrong. There's a controversy, there's a dilemma. The church says we've got to step in, we've got to talk about this. We've got to make a decision, we've got to take a position.
Which is precisely back to the authority problem,
yeah.
Which I addressed. That's exactly what I mean by why some people are so emphasizing authority, because it was attacked. And to me, as a believing Catholic, it's the authority of the church to keep me in the church. And if the authority was not within the church, there would be no point that I'd be a Catholic.
Well, okay, you just, pardon the expression, witnessed, you could say. That's you can say that's what keeps me in the church. Right, right. You are a witness. You're telling us why you're in the church, right?
I would say
the authority of the church that keeps
so
me in the church. Yes. Okay.
I mean,
okay.
I have accepted the authority of the church. If the church doesn't have any, it's pointless. It's pointless as to.
Well, I'm pretty sure nobody has said the church has no authority. I don't think that's been said.
Well, I would be one who would emphasize that as the foundation of my faith. I mean,
because what I kind of wonder
is, in my layman terms, uneducated in that area,
I could witness and say that I would feel very differently myself personally.
I know, for me,
the body and blood of Christ is more important than the authority of the church.
For the church to have authority isn't as important as where the authority comes from.
Okay.
You have authority in your home, and if I was going to be a subject in your home, I would want to know what your authority is based on. Same with the church, anyone can have, or any institution. Authority to act, I want to know where they get theirs from. Because what it's based on, where it's from, is where.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. I believe it is from Jesus. So if the church has no authority,
right.
If the authority really isn't the basis of my faith, then.
What's the point?
Jesus wasn't involved in passing that authority onto the apostles. Because the church has, because it's no big deal. It doesn't have any. I'm not making myself clear.
You're making yourself very clear, but I think you're a good example of what I'm talking about.
Have I misunderstood you?
No, for example, I would not assume that, let me give you a scenario that maybe I'm diminishing your position, and please forgive me if I am. That the moral chaos engulfs the human race, and therefore, we're celebrating Monday, the Incarnation. The Word becomes flesh and dwells among us in order to bring moral order to human enterprise and intercourse. That Christ became flesh, that God became flesh and lived among us and died and rose and ascended in order to straighten us out and make sure we all behave right. That's not the way I see it.
Well, I don't either.
Yeah. I don't think that was Christ's purpose. It wasn't to come and impose authority on us.
He came to show us the way.
Yeah. And it was all about forgiveness.
Reorienting yourself
to a totally different kind of life. A life for which, and here I'm sticking myself out, for which authority and punishment should not be necessary, but God knows they are. So far. But if the second coming, they won't be.
The power to bind and to loose, the authority to bind and to loose, has a lot to do with following the way.
Yeah, something to do. It's a necessary evil, as I said a while ago.
See, to me, it's kind of interesting because I'm trying to see the sort of grounding of your position. Because if I take it to its logical conclusion, what I conclude is that truth is completely subjective. That's where I would take it. Because it seems that the church, in and of itself, whatever it is that they choose to say is true, I mean, even the divinity of Christ, why hold that to be true? Why not allow that to be a subjective possibility, and why not sort of take a look at the self as God, that we're all gods and goddesses, which is maybe a sense of truth.
Go back to your example, please, and let me respond to that. What did you say about Christ?
Well, the fact that maybe Christ is not divine, that Christ was not true man and true God.
Well, Richard, I accept the divinity of Jesus Christ. It's a church dogma. It's not only a church dogma, it's standard. I mean, most Protestants believe that too, I think. But I'm not sure what divine means, okay? That's a word that needs to be defined. It needs to be probed very deeply. So I have somehow
come to feel in a way that I can't explain, a relationship with Jesus Christ through the church, through the Eucharist primarily. And I don't even, you know, if somebody gave me a different definition of divine or divinity, it wouldn't make any difference. It's him and me, you know? Him and us. Us, you know. It's the body of Christ. And what does it mean to be divine? You know, we're all sons of God, children of God. It's all that's in Scripture, that's even in theology, and theologians can pull it apart and put it back together again 1,000 times. But that's not where I am. I think that's fun to think about, read about, at least it was when I was younger, but I'm not much into it anymore. And that's just one example, because you brought that up, but I could probably say that about everything. The Father's authority over the family. Yes, I believe in that. But it's not when there is love, you don't have to pull the authority card. It ain't necessary.
That's between authority and power, but authority is very.
I agree, but it's all in my head.
It's very necessary. It's not authority is in my life. The validity of the position in this communication, saying the Father of the home. If you can ignore the authority because he's a good guy,
then
you just take away his foundation.
That's right. But you're right, but that's still theoretical. The best homes, I can't believe, are there because people have figured all that out. That's not where a happy home comes from, in my experience.
Well, Ben, you've been awfully quiet up till now.
Well, you ask him questions.
Would you like to respond to anything?
Just that there's no such thing as subjective truth. Truth is a statement that's a declarative statement in conformity with reality, and it has nothing to do with subjectivity.
Right. I agree.
Subjectivity is feeling.
That's right.
And
I agree.
You know, and even subject statements can be reduced to...
That's right. And I'm sure we don't want to start talking about reality and defining that, because that gets wrong not too much. Truth is a statement that conforms to reality, but reality itself needs to be defined and clarified, blah, 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 yeah. But I agree, that's a good definition of truth. All we need now is a definition of reality.
Do we have a definition of truth?
There's a statement that conforms with reality. That's good.
So we have these learned people here. Let me get this question, which has really probably not a lot to do with what we're
only
talking
if you count
about.
Yourself.
Mortimer Adler from the University of Chicago, in the Great Books Program, once made the statement that intuition was pure reason without concepts. What did he mean? If you don't know that, I don't know.
You want me to take a stab at it?
Pure reason without concepts defined intuition for Mortimer Adler. What did
a concept mean? Is an abstract category in which you classify things by a common characteristic. So you would put things in just or unjust, beautiful, ugly.
Reality.
Okay, reality. And that's what categories are, or concepts, excuse me. They're abstract classifications, sort of shelves on a library where you have fiction, nonfiction, geography, stuff like that. What I think he's saying on intuition is a feeling that comes to you without being classified in advance, sort of a direct infusion of knowledge, to use it in a religious sense. St. Paul was on his way to Damascus to persecute Christians. He was knocked down and had an immediate, direct experience with the risen Lord and Savior. He didn't know who it was, and so he didn't put him in a category. And when our Lord identified himself as who he was, St. Paul said, okay, I'm sorry, I've been on the wrong side. So he had
no preconceived ideas?
Well, he didn't have a preconceived idea unless, you know, he's leaving it out of the description he gives in, that he tells in the gospel, excuse me, in the Bible. What I'm saying is he had no preconceived, his preconceived idea was apparently that Christ was a fraud or something like that. And this was an immediate acceptance and acknowledgement of truth.
That's right.
So I think what Mortimer Adler is saying is that some things come to us either subconsciously, direct infusion of God, or direct experience without us even before. And again, the story of Archimedes, he had this task of determining whether a crown was made out of gold without destroying it. He sat in a bath and noticed that the water rose up a certain proportion to his weight, and he said, "Eureka," and supposedly ran out of the bath naked because he now figured out a way to figure out the weight of the crown. Well, he was working on a problem, but he didn't put things into categories of volume, weight, and water displacement. Instead, these things struck him, and so you could say it was an intuitive insight. I believe that that's what Adler meant, and
okay,
that's the best I can do.
I have no idea what he meant.
Well, I'm not sure either, but I think that's what he meant.
Well, you know, so many people think that their intuition and reason are in conflict. But see, he was just saying the opposite, I thought, that when he defined intuition as pure reason without concept.
Well, of course, if it contains an element, if one thing contains the other, it can't possibly be in conflict.
It's very interesting to me.
Okay.
Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
What do you not mean there? That,
I don't know.
Pure reason is the laws of logic then? That
no. Gosh, I went through this last night. Logic is a set of rules in a very specific subdivision of philosophy in which you start with a premise assumed to be true and end with a statement whose truth is dependent upon the premise.
Yeah.
It's following certain procedures. Reasoning is proceeding from one known fact and then arriving at a previously unknown fact. And the procedure by which you go are a series of sequential statements which may or may not be logical.
Mm-hmm.
So logic may be and often is included in reason, but reason itself is separate from logic. So you could have something that's extremely logical and false, but you can never have something that's unreasonable and false.
Mm-hmm.
And our reason has been grace, intuitive, means to intuit, so we can understand faith, concept, reality, thought, which we couldn't develop.
That's why this morning I seemed to be so preoccupied and not listening. Because
I thought you fell asleep. Well, I fell asleep because I was
talking.
That was because it was a reasonable thing to do.
Mr. Lewis, I was trying exactly to know I was realizing how logical you were, but I was worrying about whether or not that meant you were right.
Mm-hmm.
And I wasn't assuming.
Well, I hope you don't worry anymore.
Logical that you were.
Is Alfred E. Newman once said, "Logically, what? Me worrying?"
So, see, I was listening, but I was getting behind. What is he correct, even though he's being so logical? That's what I was dealing with, and I got lost in the melee.
Well, there's all kinds of logical fallacies.
Well, it's just about a little bit after 12. I think maybe we can kind of wrap up. Yes.
I wanted to just get back to this authority thing. I just wanted to interject this about y'all define truth. That was very good to do that. I think you should do that to every student and every time you have a chance to define truth. Conformity of mind with reality. Aquinas does that for us. He also says, since you two were talking about authority, maybe you could sum up what some of the principles we go by or that you at least agreed upon. But perhaps I ought to mention another one of Aquinas' statements is since you were talking about authority, he says that's the best argument for theology, but the best argument for philosophy is reason. Can any of you two comment on that and then try to summarize since you wish to end this?
And then there's the encyclical of Paul II, faith and reason.
Well, I agree with St. Thomas, all right, on that. All right, I think he's correct. I think that if you're arguing theology, you need authority because that way you don't make a mistake. You start with belief, then you proceed to explanation, and I think that's what St. Thomas did, because theology starts with a concept of authority. And I think he's right the other way, that when you're dealing with other issues which may be related, philosophical issues, reason is the best guide. They will, as you understand, of course, traditional Catholic teaching, philosophy is the handmaiden of theology, and therefore they will coincide and support and not conflict in any way. And the only thing I would say about authority, again, is, which I think is important, is that if the source of authority is not clearly implied, if I can use those two words together, then it definitely has to be stated. I think that someone who's pronouncing anything, if he has any position of authority, he needs to do it. It's the classic thing when someone knocks at the door and says he's a policeman, you say, may I see your badge? You're asking for identification. Now, you may not even know what the badge looks like, but this is a symbolic action saying, please establish your authority before I let you in the home. Or you've seen 1,000 times in the cop movies, where's your warrant? Where's your warrant to search this place? Okay. He's giving his official authority at that point. And so what I'm saying is, authority has to be either, everybody understands what it is. In most conventional marriages, the husband doesn't say, I, husband, hereby pronounce that dinner should be ready. No, because it's understood, all right? But if it's not understood, then I think it needs to be clearly defined. And I would say that clearly identified or clearly claimed. And I would say that this is one of the reasons that I therefore denounce Protestantism, is that their sense of authority always dissolves into a sheer matter of the lowest form of personality. And I don't mean vulgar in the sense, I don't mean bad, but I mean it always devolves down to the individual making his own decisions, throwing in the face of God, calling that truth, and then demanding access to heaven. That's not submission to the will of God. That's satanic rebellion. And it's because they accept no authority beyond their own flesh. Your turn.
That's fine. Theology, besides Aquinas, I remember reading von Balthasar, who simply called it the study of God, and would include it, even art, you know? Anything that addresses itself toward God, he would use the term theology. So theology was not necessarily, to von Balthasar, what I studied in college. And it was, you know, the handmaid of philosophy, as I say, was very Thomistic. What else? Philosophy, what did you say about that?
Well, you know, that reason would be the guiding light of philosophy, or and then it would lead you to theology, but theology, the authority, the strongest, your best theological argument would be authority.
The history of philosophy has gone through a lot of, not a lot of little changes, but several major changes. There was a piece in the New York Times Sunday that was really quite good about the Terry Schiavo, Americans say, right, case, and said that the problem came down to a clash between Aristotle and Descartes. You understand what I mean?
Yes.
Descartes, you know, kind of changed philosophy, and he really did. I mean, after Descartes, you had to be a reactionary almost to go back to Thomas Aquinas and Plato and so forth. And then there have been some changes in the 20th century too, where philosophers are only interested in symbols and mathematics and that sort of thing. So, if by philosophy you mean what St. Thomas took from Aristotle, very much agree, but there's a whole lot of philosophy that doesn't do that. This is a practical kind of observation. It might be useful to some of you. It certainly was to me. I read somebody one time talking about the controversy of same-sex marriage, and this was a Catholic priest who said this, and a scholar or academic anyway. He said that, like so many arguments, it's going like this. Because my basis misses yours. You don't understand me. And I don't understand you. And he said, it comes down to this. He said, a lot of people are grounded philosophically. And philosophically, this becomes an obvious absurdity, the same-sex marriage. But from a sociological point of view, it's not at all. Here, example. A philosopher would say, well, if you allow same-sex marriage, you might as well allow polygamy and incest. You've all heard that, right? The sociologist says, what? There's nobody wants that. There's nobody, you know, campaigning. There's no movement. There's no... That's a red herring or whatever you call it. That's not an issue.
Slippery slope.
Yeah, we have people, but the answer to that from a sociologist's point of view is we're not dealing with that. Nobody wants that. But here we have a group of people who want something. So let's think about whether we can grant it to them or not. And they don't even understand the philosophical absurdity of it. They don't understand. They don't think that way. They think like sociologists. They don't think like philosophers.
And I think that's because we live in a world of subjectivity. That we have no definitions, very good definitions. A lot of the modern Americans in the classroom, oftentimes I'll ask them about truth, the same pilot question used, and they end up with a very subjective false, and I'm unable to convince them that it is false, that there is objective truth. And that's why I quit.
Well, let me deal with that just for a second to defend your students in a sense. For 400 years, from Descartes and all them guys, the dominant intellectual drive in the Western world has been science. Now, we all know about, you know, natural science, natural philosophy. Originally, they didn't make this thing, but what today we call natural science. And a scientist doesn't believe in truth, philosophically. A scientist only deals with, you know, this is where we are today. But we are always investigating, and we expect fully that tomorrow or the next day we will discover something, we will come across something that will cancel out what we're based on today. That's philosophically where scientists are, whether they're physicists or sociologists. That's where they are.
Well, certainly, I agree.
And
certainly some of them do believe in truth, not many. Some of them.
Well, insofar as they are strictly speaking scientists, the only philosophical, ground-based truth for a scientist is you can disprove something, but you can't prove it. That's philosophically, that is the ground truth of the scientist. You can disprove things, but you can't prove anything. You can only disprove.
Yeah,
understand?
That,
well, that's... Now, you can only prove things, going back to logic and deduction and so forth, in a sense, the way you do things in mathematics. And mathematics was a great thing for Pythagoras and even for Plato. Now, the natural sciences and even the sociologists and the social workers have taken over probability and statistics and blah, 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 blah. And they're using mathematical models to further science. But you have to recognize theology and Thomistic philosophy and mathematics. You have truth and you prove truth, but you prove it because you have a ground assumption. You have to assume a certain starting point. And that is something you just have to assume. You can't demonstrate or prove it. You have to start somewhere.
Some things are self-evident. Is there a sign?
Would we call it self-evident. And if somebody comes along and says, ain't evident to me, then you're in trouble. I taught a little epistemology, and so I learned after thinking about this stuff. You say to kids, what's 10 plus 4? They say 14. I said, not necessarily, it might be 2. And they say, what? I said, 10 o'clock, 4 hours later, it's 2 o'clock. But that's not just a trick. You assume things about numbers in order to make mathematics work. Shortest distance between 2 points in a straight line? Not really. Only if there exists an infinite plane, which Euclid assumed. But such things don't exist. So they ain't true. It's only true if you accept the Euclidean system. Blah, 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 blah. So, reality, truth, they're fascinating. We should stick with them. We should worry about it. We should deal with it. But God's bigger than all that. He's better and beyond it all. And it comes down to a personal thing. Call it subjectivity if you want to. It comes down to love, and you can only love a person, not an idea.
Okay. Any last words from anyone? We've got about 5 more minutes. for any closing remarks from anyone here on our panel.
Let's leave 5 minutes early.
Well, I want to thank you very much.
Thank you, Richard.
It's been a pleasure.
And then,
thank you. All right.
And that concludes this audio CD. We hope that it has been beneficial. Thank you for listening. To obtain additional copies of this CD or any other products which ARM offers, please contact us at ARM, 55 Palin Road. That's P as in Paul, A-L-E-N as in Nancy, Road, number 3, Hopewell Junction, New York, 12533. Thank you and God bless.